Welcome to Alaska Radio Reader Rambler, your monthly potpourri of literary snacks for the mind and interviews. I'm Sandy Harper, back here with my co-host Dick Reichman, who's been very busy. He had a world premiere of a play he wrote. He played Candy in Mice and Men, and he's currently in rehearsal as Dr. Freud for Freud's Last Session. So welcome back, Dick.
Well, thank you. Good to be back.
Now, our guest today is Jim LaRuckus. And those who don't know, Jim is a noted photojournalist for 30 years for the ADN, and is now, well, I guess you're in the second act of your life, following another dream as a charter boat captain in Homer. And a matter of fact, we're, through the magic of radio, we're talking to Jim, who is in Homer while we're here in Anchorage.
That's right.
So, you know, we have your beautiful book right in front of us, Jim, and I guess we could start off by maybe you could tell us about the life and adventures of being a photojournalist for the last 30 years.
Well, Sandy, you know, and Dick, I could not imagine a better place to be a photographer and a better time to be a photojournalist in, you know, anywhere in the world, and especially in Alaska. We were just, we're blessed with a gorgeous country, wonderful people, and at the height of... in the middle of my career, we were at the height of a great Alaska newspaper war with the Anchorage Times, and we had money to do travel and as many stories and different kinds of stories as we wanted.
That's certainly reflected in your book. I noticed you took a lot of helicopter rides and things all over Alaska.
Well, that's interesting, Jim. What you're basically saying is that when newspapers compete, we get more news coverage?
I think that's a really simple equation right there. We were battling for readership, subscriptions, and that got us retail advertisers, and the money that paid for staff for the press and for the kinds of stories that we really wanted to do. So. At the height of the newspaper war, I could walk into the managing editor's office and say, "Hey, I want to go to Barrow for fall whaling," and he'd say, okay, well, put a budget together for you and a reporter." You always had to go with a reporter, right? And probably we'll go. And more often than not, we did.
And you did, because that's one of the great pictures and stories in your book about whaling in Barrow. So you guys were hungry for the scoop in those days, huh?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And that was, when I said it was the best, one of the best times to be a photojournalist, every photographer wants to work for National Geographic. And, I thought that, Anchorage would be a stepping stone, and I would go on to do other things, bigger newspaper, whatever. And I just kept coming back to what a marvelous situation it was to be, one of a dozen, maybe there were a dozen photojournalists in the state, and we were an elite group. We all knew each other. There was great camaraderie, and we enjoyed each other's competitive spirit. And at the height of all of this, there was nothing that you could imagine and not go and do.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there were these sort of planned stories, but what about the spur of the moment? Isn't that part of it? Listen to your scanner. You never knew what was going to happen.
Yeah, and those are, those are spot news events or events that happened, that were somewhere else in the state, like, the Exxon Valdez earthquakes around the state, things that you couldn't plan for, and you had to be quick-witted and be able to jump up and travel at a moment's notice, which wasn't painful at all. We loved doing it.
Yeah, well, not only the experiences, but the famous and infamous people you encountered. I'm looking at your book right now, Joe Hazelwood, and the reason is, I don't know if you know, but Dick wrote a play called The Big One all about Valdez. And you never got to meet Hazelwood in person, did you, Dick?
No, I didn't, but I certainly saw this picture that you have in your book of him many a time and looked at that face to try to figure out what kind of guy is this.
Yeah, and that isn't that something that, you know, that's, I think I say this in the book, it's my one of my favorite portraits of all time, and it's because there's a, you know, there's a pathos there that you just can't quite fathom, and he looks vulnerable and hurt, and not like the pictures that we'd seen of him up to that point that I took that portrait. They all were kind of mugshots and pretty, pretty rough looking. Not, you know, didn't give a sense of what he was like, and that's what I was going for here. So, you know, having that opportunity to meet him and kind of position him the way I wanted, I think brought a bunch of, you know, the best elements that you could bring into that kind of portrait.
Right, you even comment that it was sort of a Greek tragic figure. and you know, that's what Dick was trying to write, the complexity of the people involved.
Mm-hmm.
So...
And yeah, and, you know, that Greek connection there, it's always something that that's in the back of my mind because my last name is Greek.
Yes.
It's the name of a fish that swims in the Aegean Sea. But, you know, I'm an English major. I'm familiar with Greek tragedies. The look on that man's face was kind of a surprise, the way he presented himself. And working him, you know, the picture is of him standing in front of the Captain Cook statue, and the statue kind of looms over his head in the background, just slightly out of focus. And you know, that the connection there, of course, is that Captain Cook named Bligh Reef. And Hazelwood, I was shocked that he let me line him up like that and make that picture.
Did he take the initiative, or did you, to have that photo session?
No, in the story, I mentioned that I recognized that his attorney, Mike Chalos, was Greek, and I approached Mike and said, hey, there's this connection here with Greeks, you know, that kind of thing. You know, and we hit it off, and I convinced him that we needed a better picture of Hazelwood than what we had in our file. And when he suggested the Captain Cook, you know, Resolution Park, I jumped at it because I immediately started lining up the elements of that photograph in my mind.
Well, it's interesting. The picture agrees with what people who knew him and worked with him said about him. They found him a very sympathetic, smart, and sympathetic character all around, despite the fact that he was so vilified during the time. That picture is more like what people said he was like.
Mm-hmm. So, well, I appreciate that.
So it's the power of living history, the evidence that taking pictures, you know, those iconic pictures is all about. Kind of magical.
And, yeah, and you know, the nice thing about this book is that it does span 30 years, mm-hmm. And so we see Anchorage at a very rough boom town, Alaska, still kind of a backwater state, kind of rough to fly. It was rough flying into villages and the hubs around Alaska. You know, it just was a different kind of place 35 years ago.
And the camera equipment was different too, wasn't it, Jim? Too?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I talk about that in the book when we get into situations where we were just praying that we get any kind of image, because there were so many ways before digital photography that you could not make the photograph, that you could screw it up and not get the image that you saw and you desperately wanted to capture. Digital certainly makes it easier, but there was a certain I don't know, it's kind of adventuresome excitement to you know, did I get the picture? Did I get it? And you had to wait until you got back in the darkroom and look at that film dripping wet.
How long between when you're using film in those days, how long was it when you snapped the picture? What was the least amount of time it would take after snapping that picture that you could get it in the paper that next deadline?
Well, you know, they would tell us deadline, the drop dead, they would call it the drop dead deadline. And it would be, you know, I think back in the days when we were really pushing it, we could go to about 10 to 10:30, and the presses would start rolling around 11. So, you know, we had time to pick, to make the picture, pick the picture. But if it was an event that happened at 10 o'clock, two-alarm fire, you know, a shooting or something like that, a spot news event, then we would have to really, really hustle.
Now, with digital, how does that work? Can you get it in there much quicker?
Oh, you can get it in much quicker because, you know, for one thing, you're viewing your photographs and making mental notes about which photograph will probably be the photograph you edit to show to your boss or send by, you know, transmit by computer, which is just was a godsend when we were able to get to that point where, for example, on the Iditarod, when we were shooting film, we'd have to get our film in a, we put it in a little packet that said deadline film on it. You know, call Richard Murphy at the Anchorage Daily News Photo Department as soon as arrival in Anchorage. And we'd find somebody, you know, an Iditarod Air Force pilot or a private pilot to get our film from Nikolai or, you know, McGrath, even if they didn't have, if we'd missed the commercial flights, we'd have to find somebody to get it, to get the film back every day. And occasionally film would show up 3 days later in Anchorage. Somebody would call, oh, I have this, I have this packet of film for you. And there would be no pictures for that story for that day. So you know, when digital came along, that completely changed the game. We could shoot pictures right up to deadline and transmit them from the schools over the satellite connections at the schools.
Well, let me ask you, as a photographic artist, is there any loss now that digital dominates? Were there things artistically that you could do with film that you can't do digitally, or vice versa?
No, I think it's, you know, for one thing, we're somewhat limited as journalists, we're limited in how much manipulation that we can do to photographs. And just like when we had film, we could dodge and burn and lighten and darken. We couldn't remove elements from a photograph or change the way that we saw the original scene. And we just have to be more careful with digital because it is it's much easier to change elements in a photograph and clone things out that you don't like. But we you know, the rule was we just don't do that. And I think there is certainly more room for creativity and artistry with the digital photography in photojournalism. Because you're given more time and you're able to look at your image and seeing, okay, you know what, this picture worked better as a silhouette. Or, you know, I need to slap on a polarizing filter and get those clouds. Because now you're seeing what your results are and you can make changes at the moment there to make a better photograph.
Jim, also tell me a little bit about the ethics of being a photojournalist. You know, I'm wondering how you see that.
Well, I think that, you know, for me, having no training in journalism, you know, I took one introduction to journalism, but I really had no clue what a I wanted to be one, but I didn't know what one did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was on the job training. It was raw talent and kind employers, you know, patient employers who taught me the ethics. And you know, the main thing that I learned in journalism is that it's the trust of your readers that you rely on if they can trust you, you can get pictures of them. I guess another way to say it is, without readers' trust, you can't do your job, you gain their trust by being honest with them. So very early in my career, I learned that lying to a subject was not a good idea. I talk about it in the book where I lied to a young man who was watching his apartment burn down, and he didn't want to give me his name, and I convinced him to give me his name based on the picture that I told him we were going to run in the newspaper. And the next day it was a different photograph that we ran, and he called very angry and wanted me fired, and instead my boss, managing editor, pulled me in and said, "Look, we don't lie to our subjects. You know, it's their trust that we depend on. Don't do this again." And I took it to heart. I never did lie to a subject in that way to get what I wanted. You know, I was more respectful and honest about it.
That's an important lesson, because there's so much sensationalism and exploiting of situations and people in today's world, it seems.
Yeah, but, you know, I think that Anchorage, you know, people badmouth the media, in quotes, the media did this and the media does that, and that's why this is happening. And in Alaska, because we have people, longtime journalists here, who care about the state and you know, love the place they live in. I think that kind of sensationalism, paparazzi kind of stuff, and the, you know, the badgering that goes on that you see going on in outside with the major, you know, with big networks, that doesn't occur a whole lot here. We know we can get the story.
Mm-hmm.
If we're patient, and there's times to ask hard questions and put people on the spot and get them to answer honestly. But you know, it's not sensationalism here. I think we're lucky.
I do too. And you know, I noticed in your book you commented every once in a while, "I hit it off. We hit it off." And I imagine that's part of your secret. You're hitting it off with policemen and firemen and so on.
Yes. Yeah, and you know, you do that by remembering their name and developing a relationship with the people on the street, and that includes, you know, I was first name basis with Ziggy the Shoeshine guy, and you know, Tony Knowles and the mayors of Anchorage, and you know, it's not name dropping. It's just, it was for me a way to get the job done and use the access that I had to do my job.
And you've done a good job, Jim. You know what I like also about the book is that you do follow through, and this is what happened to this person later on, and these were the facts later on. That's a really nice element in the book, too.
Yeah. I did try to follow up on the ones that I could. There are a few that I wish that I'd taken more time to try to connect with. You know, those, especially the fellow that's in the photograph that was part of my Pulitzer, the Daily News' Pulitzer Prize entry. He's passed out on the park strip in a fetal position, and with snow coming down covering him up. And you know, I tried to find him when I was researching for the stories in the book, and I just could not find him, and I just, you know, always wondered how he did, if he ever made it. But he was in a pretty sorry state back in 1988 when I took his picture.
Was that so part of People in Peril?
It was.
Yeah.
That was part of the People in Peril series, yeah.
Yeah, that was a very important story. I wish there was more investigative journalism today. I know it's financial.
Yeah, and that's all it is. It's just, do you have the money to put, you know, two or three reporters on an issue that, a single issue that will take, you know, use their entire day when you only have, you know, limited number of reporters in the newsroom now.
Well, that leads me to a question. I was wondering, as someone who was in this business for 30 years, did you notice the shrinkage of budgets? And it seems to me, just as a consumer of news, that fewer and fewer people seem to be writing it. When I bop around the internet trying to pursue a story, I often find the same pictures and the same text at different websites, and I think to myself, are there fewer people actually gathering and writing and photographing news now, or is it just my imagination?
I think you're right. No, it's not your imagination, Dick. It's really the situation, the status of newsrooms around the country is that they've had to shrink their personnel, their employees in newsroom and around the rest of the building. You know, I'm just thinking of the Daily News, and it was a pretty sudden, dramatic downsizing that took place. And you know, we had kind of had inklings of it because travel around the state had pretty much stopped, and you know, it had to be a really, really important story to go travel outside of Anchorage. And when, you know, when we saw that kind of thing happening and budgets getting cut for equipment in the photo department and that kind of thing, we understood that the glory days were over.
Well, Jim Lavakis, what do you think that means for the conduct of a democracy, the fact that we're getting less news?
Yeah, the voter
is less informed. Does that seem to be somehow a diminishment of the effectiveness of a democracy?
That's a big question. That's the biggest question I've been asked, you know, in any of the conversations I've had with folks. What I tell people is that there will always be a place for trained journalists, because they're the ones that can get the facts, can filter things that they can understand what the important elements of a story are, and can report it in a way, write it in a way that's understandable and you know, valuable for the reader. As far as the way our democracy works, you know, I think it's still early to pronounce on that score. I think that you know, the best minds in journalism, in the business of journalism, have tried to sort out how to make this internet thing work, and it's still it's been a bumpy ride, and you know, it's all about can you pay your employees, and how do you pay your employees? So I think that there's certainly more changes and evolution that's going to occur here in the next 10 years. It may look completely different in a decade, or the way that news is disseminated. But you know, I think there's always going to be outlets, and you know, the online newspapers, the online only newspapers, I think they have maybe a foot up on the changes that are going to occur here. People of our generation still like opening a newspaper, having that broadsheet open with your coffee in the morning and scanning, and certainly pictures look better in a newspaper than they do online. There's just something more tactile about looking at a photograph.
And yet one has to wonder if the people who are doing news online, if there's sufficient advertising revenue to pay their wages.
Exactly. Exactly. Like I said, but you know, the big overhead with a regular newspaper, a daily newspaper, is that printing press. If that could go away, I'm just going to take a guess and say, you know, it's 40% or maybe 35% of the operating budget for a daily newspaper is the press, and it's, you know, the supplies that you need to produce a newspaper, and the people in that press room they're highly paid and you know, skilled individuals. So that's, I think, where newspapers have run into trouble with with that overhead of the press. But you know, I'm making some assumptions here, having talked a little bit to other people and more in the know. So I'm not sure what more to say about our democracy.
Well, thank you for taking a stab at that
right.
big one.
Yeah. Sure. Except that it's very important to have a fifth estate, a third eye, looking at things and capturing those catalytic moments.
I agree.
Yeah. I was just curious. Did you ever see the film Blow Up? Do you remember that film?
Yeah, but, you know, my those synapses that had that, they're not firing today. But, yes, I remember that there was a question of whether the picture was real or not as he blew it up.
But yeah, it was called Blow Up. He took it was kind of fascinating just finding what the truth was through the photographer's lens.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I really think it's kind of wonderful. You did a very modern thing in getting your book published. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about your use of Kickstarter and how that worked.
Oh, well, I think I just hit Kickstarter at the right time. I had pledged on Kickstarter for another project, and I was really pleased that that the project succeeded, and it felt like I had that I was invested in that project that I funded, and I was thinking I was desperately trying to find a way to raise money to make this book, and I thought, wait a minute, this is a creative venture. Why don't I try this? So, you know, I think the timing was just right. You know, it's just, I think it still is a kind of a new and exciting way for people to be involved in projects, and you know, very new and kind of. Like I said, well, new and exciting, people just kind of get on that bandwagon now. I've funded, you know, I've thrown some money into, I think, six or seven different projects now, and it's fun to get the rewards from it, and it's fun to get the updates on how the project is progressing, and so. If people don't know what Kickstarter is, it's Kickstarter.com. It's an online fundraising website, and you pitch your project to the company of the editors on the website there, and if they approve it, then you get to build your own web page on their website, asking for, you know, you basically ask for you set a goal for how much money you want.
That's inspiring for people who want to make an end run and get their creative dream, make it a reality.
Sure.
And thank you so much for being our guest. And it is a wonderful book, and you really do get a sense of the people and the history of Alaska reading it.
Thank you both.
Thank you, Jim.
Thanks to our guest today, photojournalist Jim Lavrakis. Look for his new book, Snap Decisions.
So, everybody, please join us again next month for another episode of Alaska Radio Reader Rambler with Dick Rushman and myself, Sandy Harper.